Whether it's seeking overall health, improving negative symptoms, or managing weight, we are always looking for new ways to feel better and live healthier. The American Medical Association, along with many other trusted medical professionals, have found that the cornerstone of overall health is a happy, healthy gut. Gut health plays a crucial role in promoting proper digestion, enhancing immunity, and maintaining a healthy metabolism. When those elements come together, you feel better, digest properly, eliminate waste, and absorb more nutrients. Our guts affect everything from our energy levels and mood to weight management and longevity. To improve gut health, many of us have turned to probiotics or prebiotics in the hope that they will balance what is known as the gut microbiome. So what's better than prebiotics or probiotics? How about prebiotics, probiotics, and postbiotics all in one capsule? Bioma is just that. Bioma is scientifically formulated to help you rebalance your gut bacteria. To give it a try, visit gobioma.com/rain for 15% off your first order. Bioma is not a fat burner, weight loss pill, or stimulant, although one of the key ingredients has been found to reduce belly fat percentage in just 8 weeks. Just two of Bioma's delayed-release capsules before breakfast will have your gut on a reset journey. The delay ensures the probiotic actually passes through your stomach intact, delivering more active bacteria to your gut than 96% of other probiotics. Bioma is science-backed, third-party tested, and vegan. To get started on transforming your gut and overall health, visit gobioma.com/rain. That's gobioma.com/rain for 15% off your first order. On July 9, 1967, 20-year-old Susan Galvin was taking her usual route to her night shift at the Seattle Police Department. When she failed to show up for two shifts, she was reported missing. 5 days later, her body would be found lying strangled in an elevator. Investigators searched for the culprit, but all the leads were dead ends. That was until forensic genetic genealogy was developed, and finally, a name was connected to the evidence that had been collected more than 50 years earlier. This group of three cases I'm covering has inadvertently turned into a themed series. Susan's case was another that I was asked to cover for the program Bloodline Detectives. Once I have those air dates, I will be sure to share them with you in our update episodes and on our social media so you can watch it and put some faces to the stories. So please enjoy another tale of a cold case warmed right up thanks to advancements in forensics. And Josh, I know you love these stories because they give a bit of hope that the bad guy will always be caught, even after they think they've gotten away with it. The most notable event in Seattle in the 1960s was the 1962 World's Fair. The fair brought the city the monorail, the iconic Space Needle, and 10 million visitors over 6 months. Post-World War II, the population of Seattle was also becoming more diverse, although discrimination would remain legal in the state until 1968. Ooh. In 1967, the population of Washington was right around 3 million. That year, the state was home to 96 murders, 387 rapes, and 2,585 aggravated assaults. That would be the last year the state would experience double-digit homicides, as every year since has been in the triple digits. In 2019, there were 198 murders, 3,332 rapes, and 13,700 aggravated assaults statewide. Much like today, Seattle's social issues were focused on anti-war, anti-racism, and anti-police brutality. Like the change in homicides in Portland I spoke about in the Anna Marie Lavka episode, Seattle experienced a similar shift from bar fights and stabbings to indiscriminate shootings and stranger-to-stranger killings. A current issue the Seattle Police Department complains about is staffing. These issues aren't always cut and dry, though, as the cycle tends to be hey, we need more money for staff. Then when they get the money, it's spent on things like overtime, pay raises, and military-grade equipment, while the department remains understaffed. Besides a chunk of the budget going to payroll increases, in 2021, Washington State settled 15 wrongful death or misconduct suits, totaling just short of $35 million. In the last 5 years, Washington has paid out over $100 million in lawsuits. Just throwing those numbers out there in case a department is looking to hire people and they need money. Maybe if you stopped wrongfully killing people, you'd be able to have more coverage, close more cases, and keep more killers off the streets. The Seattle Police Department blames its staffing issues for its meager 24% homicide clearance rate in 2021, meaning if you murdered someone, you had a 76% chance of getting away with it. For those unfamiliar with Seattle, the center of the city is, well, Seattle Center. It was first developed at the turn of the 20th century as a public land space. It was then chosen as the location for the World's Fair in 62.
Everybody's planning to see Seattle's spectacular $100 million World's Fair.
So pack up your troubles and forget your cares. Pack up your family and head for the fair in Seattle.
Welcome to the future and all the wonders of the 21st century in the greatest preview the world has ever seen.
Take away a head, look at tomorrow, just as if you were there.
Rocket ride to Mars in the breathtaking U.S. Science Pavilion. See the fabulous city of tomorrow in the gigantic, wall-less, pillarless Colosseum. Have fun with the happy-go-lucky crowds.
Pack up the trouble.
For 6 wonderful months.
Back up your family and head for the fair.
It's the big thrilling adventure of a lifetime. Opening April 21st to October 21st in Seattle.
After the fair came to the end of its six-month run, the six-block-by-six-block space remained a public area, home to a playground, armory, auditorium, ice arena, and more. Being that it was so tourist-heavy, the center was considered a safe, family-friendly part of town. Besides the hordes of visitors, there were staff at the different locations and fairgrounds and security personnel who monitored the area. Seattle Center remains an important economic lifeline for the city. The Space Needle alone brings in 1 million visitors annually. The entertainment buildings would eventually be converted into convention and sports coliseums, where back in the day, the Beatles played a $5 show and the Seattle Supersonics had their first and last games, rips. Fun personal fact, my first post-COVID concert was Paul McCartney at the Climate Pledge Arena in the Seattle Center. The building and crowd were just a smidge bigger, and my ticket was just a pinch more than the $5. Like any main city center, Seattle's had a parking structure. At 7 p.m. on Thursday, July 13th, 1967, Joe Burslon, a parking lot attendant, was unlocking the elevators in the Seattle Center structure, which had been locked down the previous Sunday, as was normal procedure when there wasn't an event scheduled at the center. When the doors opened to one of those elevators, Joe was shocked to see the body of a young woman lying on the floor. Her head was up against the back corner of the wall, her legs and feet spread apart. Police were called and detectives arrived to process the crime scene. Unlike most cases where a body is found and either documentation, family members, or dental records provide identification, the police knew right away who the victim was. She was 20-year-old Susan Galvin, and they knew her because she worked for the Seattle Police Department. Susan's family was called at 2 a.m. and informed of the dreadful discovery. It was learned that when Susan failed to show up for her night shift on Sunday, a coworker marked her down as having taken a vacation day. It's unclear if they thought they were covering for Susan, had been misinformed, or simply made the assumption. But when Susan missed her following shift, which was totally out of character, a missing persons report was filed. After getting past the shock of knowing the victim, the investigative team gathered her clothing for evidence and dusted the elevator for fingerprints. To make sure they got everything, they even removed part of the railing from inside the elevator car. As for Susan, her underwear had been sliced open, her clothing was violently ripped off of her body, and she had been sexually assaulted. Investigators felt Susan had either been attacked in the garage and dragged into the elevator, or she'd been attacked once inside the car. Whoever did this had taken her by surprise, as she had no defensive wounds, just a small injury to the bridge of her nose. An autopsy showed that Susan's cause of death was manual strangulation. No weapon was found at the scene, so it was believed she was strangled by either the perpetrator's hands around her neck or a hand being held over her nose and mouth. It was a brutal scene. Based on how aggressively the attacker behaved, and in such a public place, investigators felt that they hadn't been concerned about being caught, or they were confident they wouldn't be. The location was, in a way, the first lead. Was the killer someone familiar enough with the area to know that the garage would be locking the elevators for a week, or had that just been dumb luck? The double helix of DNA had only been discovered 14 years before Susan's murder, so the idea of using DNA to find a killer was quite literally unheard of. There was such little technology available at the time that there weren't even security cameras in the parking garage or surrounding areas to aid in the investigation. Besides a lack of technology, there was even less known about this kind of behavior. Susan's murder happened at a time when the idea of stranger-to-stranger killings or a serial killer was not in the everyday lexicon like it is today. At the time, John Dwight Kanaday, a serial rapist and murderer, was active in the area, but it was still rare, or at least not very widely accepted, that a person could be brutally murdered for what appeared to be no reason. And yes, I will be covering John Dwight Kanaday because I had not heard that name before, and he is on the list. Susan's murder was so jarring, investigators didn't rule out whether this was an attack from a stranger or someone she knew. They had to follow all the leads. Susan could have been stalked by a person who knew her schedule. It could have been a crime of opportunity, or maybe someone had been with her and she felt comfortable getting into the elevator with them. No matter what the relationship was between the killer and victim, this murder was carried out by a dangerous individual. Susan Galvin was a 20-year-old woman who moved to Seattle just a year before her death. She was born in Bedford, Massachusetts, before moving to Spokane, which is nearly 300 miles east of Seattle, almost at the border of Idaho. She had two sisters and four brothers. As the oldest in the brood of seven, she was often in charge of her siblings. It appears her parents may have been divorced, as her father lived in Portland. After graduating from North Central High School, Susan attended Spokane Community College. Even though it was the Pacific Northwest in the 60s, Susan was not a counterculture kid. She was looking forward to a straight-laced life and career. She took the first step in that direction by pursuing a job with law enforcement. A few months after moving to Seattle, she landed a job with the Seattle Police Department as a records typist clerk. Susan's schedule had her working the night shift, where she enjoyed the peace and focus that the quiet office hours provided. She was known for being friendly and focused and had perfect attendance, which is why her team was so worried when she hadn't come into the office that second shift. It was wholly out of character for her. As they would with any investigation, detectives looked into Susan's personal life. They found that she had made some friends after moving to the area, and she had a good relationship with her coworkers. She had been on a couple of dates, but she wasn't seeing anyone. As for her family, they were in Spokane and Portland. Tracing Susan's steps, investigators were able to create a timeline of her final days. On Sunday, July 9th, Susan was headed into work and took her usual shortcut through the Seattle Center parking garage. The garage would be closed to new cars at 6:30 p.m. that Sunday. The elevators remained operational as there were still vehicles parked in the garage and people would need to be able to leave and get to their vehicle. The elevators themselves wouldn't be turned off until the early morning hours for that same reason. Investigators began looking for witnesses in and around the Seattle Center, which proved to be a nearly impossible task as there were so many people around. A neighbor of Susan's did tell investigators that she had seen Susan walking toward the center the night of her murder. She wasn't sure on the time, but it did match with the timeline of Susan being killed while on her way to work on Sunday. Susan's murder was never really front page news, outside of a few small articles in the corner. Her death had more of an effect on the police department internally, as they were now trying to solve the murder of one of their own. They shared what they could with journalists in hopes that tips would come in, but it didn't seem to do much. Every paper in the area had a blip about the discovery of Susan's body, and she remained in the news until July 29th. After that, nothing was published about her case, not even that it had gone cold. In the last article to mention Susan's murder, before a break in the case that came in 2019, a It was late July 1967, 18 days after her murder. At the bottom of the last page of the Tacoma News Tribune, before a barrage of advertisements, it read, quote, "Police seeking dead girl's pal. A young woman believed one of the last persons to see Susan Galvin alive is being sought by Seattle police, who emphasized she is not a suspect in the case. The woman was seen with Miss Galvin entering the latter's apartment about 9 p.m. on July 9th. An autopsy showed Miss Galvin, a police department records clerk, was suffocated about 2 hours later. Her body was found in the Seattle Center parking garage elevator 4 days later. Miss Galvin's mother lives in Spokane." It's unclear if that pal was ever tracked down. Even if she had been, it would stand to reason that she wouldn't have been able to assist the investigation very much. Her friend was killed 2 hours after their visit. Who knows if they were even close enough friends to talk about anything that would have been pertinent. What police were probably seeking was if Susan had had any enemies or disgruntled men in her life that could have been responsible for her death. And it didn't seem this friend provided any information along those lines. Since the media and friends weren't able to provide information that led to a break, investigators focused on the Seattle Center itself. Dozens of employees at the center were interviewed. Most everyone was cleared and couldn't offer much helpful information. However, at least one employee recalled seeing Susan on the afternoon of Sunday, July 9th. At that time, Susan was walking hand in hand with a young man whom the witness assumed she was on a date with. Several witnesses in the area were asked about Susan and the man, which landed a suspect on the police radar early on, as it seemed Susan had been seen with this man just hours before her death. Several people told police about him, as he was fairly well known for working in the center as a clown. Even off-duty and makeup-free, people could tell it was him. The zone the clown operated in was just half a mile from the garage, so he was familiar with the area. When witnesses were asked what they knew of the clown, they didn't really know much, except that he was known for being a bit of a ladies' man. He her.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly, of course, what I was thinking.
Police wanted to speak with the clown, so they went to the headquarters of the business he worked for. Investigators were alarmed to learn that on the Monday after Susan's death, before she was reported missing and days before her body would be found, the man didn't come into work. He was also a no-show on Tuesday as well. That Wednesday, he did go into the office, but only to quit. Was he just a weird guy and this was all an unfortunate coincidence? Or were these actions of a killer clown? These suspicious actions left investigators eager to speak with him. They were able to track him down and they questioned him. They noted his behavior was alarming. He was hesitant to answer questions and clearly was not taking the process seriously. But what do you expect from a clown, really?
He kept pulling hankies out of his shirt.
Right.
Forever.
He even denied knowing Susan. When officers asked about the witnesses who had seen him with her, he just shrugged it off. Asking for an alibi the night of the murder, the clown claimed to have worked into the evening before going home, which was only 3 blocks from and in the path of the crime scene. Because he was alone, the alibi could not be verified. He was given a polygraph test, and he didn't fail, but the results were inconclusive. All of that combined, there still wasn't enough evidence to arrest him, and he was free to go. Then there was Jay, Susan's friend from high school. The pair had been toying with the idea of a romantic relationship as they had known each other in school, and it seemed Jay was a bit smitten with Susan. She wasn't as keen on him, though, but they did give dating a try. Everything changed when, one night at work, Susan came upon an arrest record and learned Jay had been arrested for possession of LSD. Because this went against her staunch moral compass, she abruptly ended the relationship. Police thought that perhaps Jay was a scorned lover and lashed out at Susan. He was interviewed about Susan's death and claimed to have nothing to do with it. His denial, paired with a verifiable alibi from the night of the murder, had Jay quickly cleared as a suspect. Investigators then learned that a week before her murder, Susan and a friend had gone on a double date with some sailors. The group of four went to the Seattle Center and enjoyed the attractions. After the date, the foursome made plans for a follow-up date the next weekend, but it never came to fruition. Digging into the leads, detectives were able to locate the sailors who were stationed on a ship at the Bremerton Naval Base just across the sound from Seattle. They took a ferry and went aboard the ship to question the young men. The sailors were surprised to learn of Susan's death. They had no problem speaking with detectives and told them all they could to help. They confirmed they had gone out with Susan and her friend that weekend before her death and that they had made plans for the following weekend, but for whatever reason, that date fell through. The men shared the alibis they had from the weekend of July 8th. Between that and their past polygraphs, those men were also cleared. Two more suspects off the list. Now that those who had last been seen with Susan were cleared, detectives needed to switch gears and look at other possible scenarios. Like the situation with Jay, could the killer have been connected to Susan's work? Did she find an unsavory police report or know something about someone's arrest that put her in danger? Looking into her work and personal life, that just did not seem to be the case. Another option was a stalker. If someone watched Susan for even a short while, they would have learned her routine pretty quickly. If the perpetrator was familiar with the area, it could have been possible that they would have known about the garage closure schedule and that it would have been empty at the time. Police couldn't prove it, but it seemed like more than a coincidence that Susan would be murdered and her body would be left in such a popular area that just so happened to be closed for almost a week. These were all great theories, but again, we're talking about the late 60s. There was nothing even resembling a digital footprint to narrow down who had been in the area at the time. No cameras, no debit cards, no cell phones, no GPS, no pinging, nothing. Just a lot of people from a lot of places. Without so much as a whisper of a lead, Susan's case grew colder and colder. Besides the lack of technology, if the killer had been a tourist or from out of town or transient or moved soon after, they had a four-day head start on the authorities. However, if you were to ask the SPD, they might say that the case was never considered cold. Through the years, her file was passed on to each newly assigned detective who was always actively working on it as much as they could. This was a dark stain on the history of the Seattle Police Department, and they were desperate to solve the murder of their own employee. Susan's family, especially her brother Larry, had remained in contact with the Seattle Police. Not that they spoke that often. What is there to talk about after 30, 40, 50 years? Hey, sorry, still nothing. Of course, the family grieved the loss of their sister, daughter, friend, but through the years, that grief began to morph into frustration. Worry that the assailant would never be known grew stronger with each passing year, as did the disappointment. It wasn't like new evidence was just going to start popping up after all that time. As the years ticked by, eventually both Susan's mother, Helen, and father, John, passed away before they could learn the identity of their daughter's killer. In 2002, technology had finally advanced to a point that allowed for a new step to be taken in Susan's case, DNA testing. Thankfully, and get ready with that good police work bell, Josh. Ooh. The evidence had been collected and stored so well that it didn't matter that the pieces were nearly 40 years old. They were still suitable for testing. Hooray!
Just do it right the first time, you know?
And they did.
Measure twice, cut once.
That's right.
We got one!
The unknown DNA from the scene was sent to the Washington State Crime Lab, and a DNA profile of an unknown male was created. This was a huge break. The investigation had the profile. Now they just needed a name. Hoping and assuming the man who had left the DNA had committed other felonies, the profile was uploaded to CODIS, the national database where the DNA of convicted felons is stored for this exact purpose, to try and match it to unsolved and/or related cases. Fingers were crossed that the capture of the owner of the DNA profile would be as easy as running it through CODIS. Those hopes were dashed when there was no match in the system. This could mean the man responsible for Susan's death had never been arrested for a felony, was already arrested, like Jerry McFadden in the Anna Marie case, or he was already dead. In order to answer that question, investigators were going to have to find a new way to put a name to that DNA. In 2016, yet another detective was assigned to Susan's case. His name was Detective Rolf Norton, and everyone in the cold case department was hopeful that he would be the one to finally close her case. Going through the massive five-decade-long file, Rolf was delighted to see how much work had been done by the detectives before him. Rolf decided the best place to start would be to eliminate suspects that they had investigated in the past. At the top of that list was the Seattle Center clown. Presenting the information they had, that the clown was the last one to be seen with Susan, that he abruptly quit his job and moved the week between her death and the discovery of her body, and his erratic behavior, it easily created enough probable cause to get a judge to approve a search warrant of the clown's property and to acquire a DNA sample.
Did you say what type of clown he was?
No, the clown is actually tricky. I couldn't find his name. I couldn't find anything about him, really. It's pretty vague. And what do you mean by type of clown?
Party clown, street clown.
I think street.
Crime clown, a busker.
I think it was whatever business, either contracted through Seattle Center or whatever, and he's just out in the area.
Oh, part of the gayway or something.
I think he was just kind of like a local entertainment. Here I am. So I pictured in my mind, I pictured real traditional. Red hat, polka dot pants.
Floppy shoes.
Yeah.
Dick Van Dyke and the Golden Girls.
Yes, exactly. So armed with the search warrant, Detective Norton and his team went to Utah and tracked down the clown. He was shocked to open his door and find a team of detectives who were still asking him about a person from 40 years prior. The detectives were also shocked. The clown and his home were described by one of the detectives as eccentric, with garbage and property strewn all about the house. It was such a mess, the detectives struggled to find a place to sit. The guy was strange, but he was willing to talk. He continued to deny having known Susan. Even when Rolf brought up the fact that witnesses had placed him with her just before her murder, he continued to be strange and evasive about it. The interview itself led nowhere, but the detectives weren't really worried about that. They wanted the DNA. It would answer all of their questions. The clown had no problem providing the sample, which was sent to the state's crime lab immediately. It would only be a 2-week wait before detectives got word back from the lab. The clown was not a match for the DNA from Susan's scene, and he was once again, and for the final time, cleared as a suspect. The investigation was as close to being solved as it had been in 67. Everything changed in 2018 when the Golden State Killer was captured with the use of forensic genetic genealogy. When Detective Norton heard about that case and how similar the situation was to Susan's, he got excited. The Golden State case had a DNA profile, but no CODIS match. Following a family tree related to the DNA, they were able to narrow down the probable suspects, which led them to Joseph James D'Angelo, who they confirmed through DNA had been the perpetrator. Detective Nolan would have to get approval to go through a special third-party lab for the forensic genetic genealogy, which he did receive. Samples from Susan's case were sent to the lab, and the scientists were shocked and elated that even though the samples were so old, they too were still suitable to go through the next phase of testing.
Yeah! 2 in 1 day.
I know. It would take 4 months for Rolf to receive an email from the lab. Almost nonchalant, the email read, "There is a strong likelihood your suspect is Frank Whippich." Rolf went through the massive case file skimming for Frank's name, and he had never been on the radar in any capacity. Rolf finally had a name, but no clue who this guy was, so the investigation into Frank began.
Whippich?
Yep.
Horrible.
W-Y-P-T-C-H.
That's the least vowels I've ever heard.
Isn't that incredible? Yeah, there are no vowels.
It's like rhythm. Whippich.
Sometimes Y.
Sometimes.
And in this case, it's the sometimes.
Wow.
More like whip bitch.
You fucking clown. I know it's not him.
But he's the clown.
You're the clown.
Frank Whippich was researched, and it was quickly learned that he had spent some time in the army and at one point had been a security guard. And Josh, you might need to make a bell or siren of some sort, some kind of noise for when our suspect is a handyman, maintenance guy, or a shady security guard? Because I know we've covered other cases where the security guard is the victim. Not those guys.
A key ring jingle or something.
Oh, yeah.
When you said, I thought it was just going to be security guard and it was going to be like the squeaky brakes on a bicycle as they like come. They're like,
but you know,
stop
the guys.
Resisting. Yeah, I do.
The ones that have the access and sort of authority.
Just enough.
Not only had Frank been in a position of authority, but it was reported he had been working security at the Seattle City Center, meaning he not only knew the area very well, but it was very possible that he knew the garage was going to be closed. Because of the security job, his fingerprints were on file. Using the fingerprints, which had been collected from the control panel of the elevator at Susan's scene, which were not only collected, but again, stored properly, they were compared to the ones on file for Frank. And they were also a match. Frank Whippich was born in 1941 in Seattle. At the time of Susan's murder, he was a 26-year-old married father to a son. His second son would be born 2 years after the murder. Frank and his wife divorced in 1971. That was the same year he was arrested and served 9 months for larceny. His only other offense was when he was arrested on a weapons charge in 1975, hence his DNA not being in CODIS. But calling Frank's second legal issue a weapons charge is really underplaying it. That's because the original charges had been lessened to that. Originally, he had been arrested for dressing up as and impersonating a police officer. He would pull people over and wield a gun to intimidate them. Because he only had the larceny charge on his record, the charges were brought down to weapons.
Was he robbing them?
He wasn't robbing them, and I didn't find anything as far as what he did. I don't think he did anything to anyone. People either were figuring it out or he just let them go. So I don't think anything came from that action. I don't know what, maybe he was just testing it.
Oh, to see if he could.
Can I get away
enforce
with.
Enforce control over people.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But very shady. I mean, that's like Ted Bundy level.
It's not funny like that movie, Let's Be Cops. I mean, it isn't also funny like that movie, Let's Be Cops.
Also not funny.
It's not funny.
There's no time it's funny. Detectives were now armed with irrefutable probable cause. Frank could be placed at the scene, so it was assumed his DNA would be a match. They would just need a sample from him to prove it, which they would never get. Looking further into Frank's life, they learned Frank had died in 1987 from diabetes complications. When your lead suspect is deceased, you don't have access to their DNA. The only way to prove the findings of the forensic genetic genealogy was to take a drastic measure. After arguments and approval, Frank's body was exhumed from his grave at the Riverton Crest Cemetery in Tukwila, Washington. So I should say, it wasn't that they would never get the DNA. It would just take some effort. Even exhumation was not going to be a guarantee, though. The scientists involved in the case weren't sure that they would be able to procure enough bone marrow from Frank's corpse that wasn't too broken down to be able to test. The body was removed and the marrow was found, and they could test it. Amazingly, the test worked, and they were able to say definitively Frank Whippich had been Susan Galvin's killer. That's right. Got you out of the grave. Rolf Norton was excited to call Susan's family, though his news was bittersweet. Yes, they had a name for the killer, but he would never be held accountable or face punishment. Frank's name was the only question surrounding Susan's murder that would ever be answered. Detectives would have to just take a guess and assume what occurred that night in the elevator. The best they could come up with was that the attack was one of sexually motivated opportunity. Susan and Frank might have interacted before her death, or perhaps he had been watching her from afar, or they simply crossed paths in that moment as she was walking to the elevators and he struck. It's also possible he was wearing his security uniform, so having company in the dark parking lot as she went to work may have been deceptively comforting. There are two ways Frank managed to avoid being caught in the 20 years from the murder to his own death and the 30 years following. He either never committed another heinous crime like what he did to Susan, or he was really good at what he did and chose victims that were never connected and/or he never left evidence. The best case scenario is that he was scared after what he did to Susan and he didn't hurt anyone else through the remainder of his life. It would be hard to imagine that this public murder, where Frank could have so easily been caught, was his first killing or sexual assault. That kind of crime usually builds up from lesser ones. So if we were to learn that he was connected to another assault or a missing person or murder, I would not be the least bit surprised. And so often, we find that people who have caused harm to others are in positions of power. It really isn't surprising that Frank went on to pretend to be a cop. He probably enjoyed the small amount of authority he had as a security officer. Like we see with maintenance men, they have access to people and places. They have perceived authority, and they aren't usually questioned. I've heard it said so many times by survivors that they knew in their gut that the situation was wrong, but as a woman especially, we're taught not to speak up, not to question that authority, especially back in the 60s. Officially, Susan's is the oldest case to be closed by using forensic genetic genealogy. This case was given extra attention and care because the victim was connected to the police department, but hopefully it serves as a reminder that every crime scene should be treated with the same amount of care and all evidence should be preserved as best as possible. There's no telling what technology will eventually come along, and a case could be solved with the smallest detail. Police work has become more and more technology-based. Solving a murder isn't what it used to be, just interviewing witnesses, finding clues, catching the killer. Now it's all about the evidence. When police work together with crime scene investigators, scientists, and labs, families can get justice and killers can come off the street. I believe we've only seen the start of what forensic genealogy can do. It's going to be an uphill battle because it is usually appealed in court, but as the technology and skills behind making those connections get better, I do think that we're going to see more and more cases come to a close. For the families waiting to receive the kind of news that Susan's was, I hope that this story serves as a reason to not give up hope. We are seeing more and more often that people who care will come up with ingenious ways to solve a case. So even if you don't have the best evidence or leads, you never know what might change and bring those answers. And for those who have committed a heinous crime like what was done to Susan, I hope the story serves as a reminder that you have not gotten away with anything. You've just earned yourself more time on the outside. These crimes will inevitably be solved, so you can continue to worry every day that a knock might be coming to your door, taking you away forever. You might even die not being caught, but you will be connected to what you did, and that will be your legacy. Just like Frank Whippich, it will be an embarrassment for your family to carry forever. So sleep tight.
Is it that much effort, extra effort, to store the things properly?
It doesn't seem like it.
How did it happen in this case? And it doesn't happen so often.
Yeah, and with Anna Marie's case as well. And she was not related to the police, but that was equally competent storing. But I don't know what that is. I don't know if that's training to the individual departments, if it's just the individual officers, I don't know. But that's supposed to be the goal and the focus, and the everything is about finding out who did it. And here's the thing in your hand that will tell you eventually who did it.
As the person solving it, why wouldn't you want it to be solved?
Yeah.
With proper evidence collection and storage.
And even though there's no proof of him doing anything after Susan's case, besides the larceny and the impersonating a cop, it's another one where they lessened the damn charges. And mathematically, I wouldn't have been surprised if he had survived. If you look at that and go, well, if they had charged him accurately as impersonating a cop, he would have had X number of years. But instead, he got a few months and then he was out and did something horrible. It's another one where it's like, oh, you only had the larceny and you were just pretending to be a cop. We'll just give you a weapons charge.
You little cutie.
Yeah. Once again, saying, oh, you can do bad stuff. You'll just get a slap on the wrist. Go ahead. Keep trying the system. See what you can get away with.
So much.
So much. See how little jail time you'll have to do.
Not much.
So little. So if they do the crime, they got to do the time. Save the evidence, collect the evidence, and don't give up. Those are the lessons from today's episode.
I hope that clown is chasing him around in hell. Can you imagine a killer clown?
That would be hell.
Good night, everybody.
much like today's. Mm-mm.
What's that sound?
Don't miss it.
Monorail.
Monorail.
That's right. Monorail.
It's only not Tacoma because they have the sports teams, maybe.
No weapon was found at the scene, so it, I don't think I could do it. Date a clown.
You married one.
Not a buffoon.
Not a little goof, a little silly goose.
A little goose. I'm talking full-fledged professional clown.
It's tough to deal with. All the...
It scares me.
Well, what? The thought of it?
Clowns.
Oh, do they really?
I don't like them.
Wow.
Not scared like I can't be near, but just...
Would prefer not to be?
A shudder through my body.
Yeah.
But I think that goes back to that fever dream of killer clowns from outer space I had as a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like the opposite version of the yoga guy who had to go to anger management. The guy from Gigolos.
Mm-hmm.
The namaste guy.
Yeah.
And you're like, The opposite of that is the clown. We're like, I don't. What's the other side of this?
Yes.
Why
flip
did you
that coin,
do it?
Baby?
Yeah.
Bozo.
Mm-hmm.
Bobo.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever your name is.
Honk that Bobo. Untrustworthy.
Well, they are wearing a paint mask.
Yeah.
And they're trying. Then the mask is often a smiley mask.
Yeah.
That's true.
Painted on.
Yeah. Give me a sad clown. I can handle that.
Yeah, that feels real.
That's just like a person.
Yeah. That I did marry.
Yep.
If I held
a little flower, it would go boo. Rubber chicken down my pants. Ha 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 ha.
Rumors.
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 The husbands.
Or as Nomi would say.
Different places.
Did you tell me?
It's really not surprising that Frent went on. Frent? Hello?
Monorail.